Before we do all that, I want to introduce my co-host for today. Please welcome to the show, Carol. Carol, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good, how are you? I suppose the best way to start being a mental health.
Well, I'm very well, apart from a bit of a panic at the beginning, but it's all go, but I'm raring to go.
Yeah, we should actually mention the egg. Apologies if any...
It's very hot in here, I must say.
It is, kind of, yeah, looking at the windows open, so we're not, you know, burning through the ridges here. But we should apologise, actually. Anyone who wanted to promote us or who wanted to listen to us from 2 o'clock, we had some issues, so apologies if you wanted to tune into us through then. But all is clear now, but we have a really packed show. We've got loads coming up. We're going to be talking about blogging. In regards to mental health, like how it feels to be a student, obviously with all the difficulties that involves. We're also going to be talking to a clinical psychologist who's going to be talking about OCD and also CBT, as in cognitive behavioural therapy, and all sorts of stuff in the show. So we're going to move right along. The first segment we're going to be talking and listening to is going to be Bill and Scotty, who are going to be talking about mental health in the workplace. So without further ado, this is Bill and Scott talking about that very subject, and you're listening to Mentally Sound right here on Gravity Radio North East.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Mentally Sound, which is part of Gravity Radio North East. You have to...
But what that basically means is I have issues with impulsivity, I get irritable quickly, I'm literal, the list could go on. So because of the place I work, which is a call centre... which is quite hard. You've got noises all around you, people talking, trying to hear what the person's saying. Yeah, it's a lot to contend with.
It is indeed, because I too have ADHD, and I too have had many problems in the workplace, and I've worked a lot longer than you, and therefore I've amassed a bigger range of problems.
No.
Okay. Yeah, so tell me a bit more about your recent experiences.
Well, it's been kind of an ongoing thing. When I was a presenter for a certain bingo type channel thing, I was pulled aside and said, look, I think you've got a form of autism, and I had no idea what that was, heard of the word, and to be honest with you, it took me a little bit of time to get referred. I went to the GP, and cut a very long story short, it was finally diagnosed. I was late diagnosed when I was about 33. I'm now 37. I don't look it.
Yes, you do.
Thanks. But yeah, and now it was like, hallelujah. I have a reason to why I'm fidgety. I have a reason to why my brain works so fast and I can't control it. But now I'm on medication. Not everyone medicates. Some people, like yourself, do the alternative route, which I've been interested in. But yeah, it works for me. And then I kind of thought I could do a screenplay about it. I really want to show. I had a vision of this little boy sitting on the floor with his, I think it was his family around him, but he couldn't relate to them. And that's kind of how I felt. And the title being Misunderstood, it...
Perfect title.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I still feel that way sometimes.
Yeah.
But I'm in a much better place. But only because someone called Rory Bremner, he actually has ADHD as well.
Yes.
But he doesn't do anything with it. But he, as you can tell when he talks, is all over the place. Fidgety, impulsivity. He emailed me today, said that he's impatient, and I am too. So that in the workplace, along with other people that might have issues as well, there's anxiety, there's depression that we all know about, and there's a lot of other things, Asperger's. There's many things in the workplace that people don't know. They don't know that they have a mental health issue potentially. And for me, are the people who are their line managers, the employer, do they know how to react to it? Have they got procedures in place for that? Luckily for me, my manager used to be a carer for someone with autism. So for me, I'm very lucky. But my manager before that, nope, didn't have a clue. And the sanction I had, the person had no idea. Put me in a very nasty situation, which I was, but I couldn't get out of. And I had to make a complaint about that person, which thankfully went further ahead. So...
Can I just interrupt you then? Do you think if anybody's experiencing these sort of things, they might want to get in touch with us?
Do you know what? I really think they should, because this is why this has all been set up. Mentally Sound Radio is a great project, because at the end of the day, if somebody, Joe Public, Sarah Green, whatever your name is out there, and you're walking about, you're sitting there, or you're struggling in general, or at your work, and you don't maybe know that you are in this situation,
mm-hmm.
then get in touch, because
mm-hmm.
we can use our experience to help out,
mm-hmm.
and that's what we're going to be doing.
Fantastic. You mentioned Rory Bremner before, and he was a huge inspiration to me mm-hmm. when we started to set up the ADHD support group in Newcastle.
Wow.
Which is actually a regional group, as you well know.
That's fantastic.
It is an amazing thing.
I love it.
Yeah. Because when I was diagnosed with ADHD, there was no help out there. So.
Well, there still isn't.
Yeah.
There's still people saying it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Well, I would like to say to those people that it does exist. Come and meet us. You'll find out it does exist. But I can tell you now, there's going to be a whole, and I'm pretty sure you said at the start, there's going to be a series of all other mental health or mentally sound team members talking about this, but you and me.
In actual fact, I forgot to mention the fact that there's going to be several features about mental health in the workplace. Yeah.
Okay.
And we'll also be covering some more stuff to do with ADHD as well.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And there's other ways. There's Facebook, there's probably a Twitter page, there's going to be lots of ways of getting in touch with us via Gravity Radio North East, so please do that. And
we really would love to hear from you all.
I would, or because you read an email.
Yes,
that'd be good.
Yeah, so it would be wonderful
for me.
And I think, unless I'm mistaken, you actually have to leap away a bit to work right now, because you might get in trouble if you don't.
I might do.
Yeah.
So enough about us.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah. Get in touch with Mentally Sound
and
Gravity Radio North East.
I like it. Take care. Bye bye.
And say, like, oh, I think I've got ADHD, and not actually realise kind of what it's like. I believe you can hear me now, which is great. Apologies again for the technical errors. As I say, there was a monumental failure about 10 minutes before we were due to start, so there's stuff seemed to be phasing in and out. But you can apparently hear me again now. So as we were saying, we were talking about ADHD, because Bill and Scott's segment was on that, and about mental health in the workplace. Have you ever experienced... Have you ever worked in positions where mental health's
yes,
come up?
Yes, I have. I used to be a nurse, did very little mental health, but I did once work in an ADHD centre, and the behaviour can be so rapidly different. Some of the children had, you know, special hats on because they kept banging their heads
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And as Scotty said, it was misdiagnosed, wasn't it? They thought he had autism.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like it parallels with autism. And
it's very often the case, isn't it, that stuff with mental health often gets misdiagnosed, and then you have people who are spending a great deal of time struggling to find out what actually kind of condition they have. So it's interesting that throughout the show we're going to have different mental health disorders and illnesses that, you know, hopefully you'll, you know, give some more information out there and make things a little bit more...
Well, it's good because science is so advanced. It's always progressing, isn't it?
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Different views. People have got their own take on what ADHD is and what autism is and what mental health is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good to have people live here in the studio telling us what the real take is.
And also to fix problems. That's always good to have people. So thank you to all the technical support. We hopefully have fixed that all now. If you want to get in touch with us, we should have mentioned this at the beginning of the show. We have mentallysound@gravityradionortheast.co.uk is the email address if you want to get in touch with us. We'd love to hear if you're willing. You can obviously make it anonymous if you want in regards to emails. If you want to tell us your experiences about mental health, is there anything you want to ask us? We obviously have our own experiences with mental health, so we can certainly do that. But what I need to tell you is about what's coming up in the show. The next segment we're going to be is about poetry. Are you a poetry fan, Carol?
Yes, I write poetry.
Do you do any yourself? Or?
Yes, I do. My poetry is not the dark type. I like doing stuff on love and on my paintings, my own paintings. I tend to marry my poetry up with my paintings.
Mm-hmm.
So I like talking about summer and earthy stuff and
mm-hmm.
creation, basically. So, yes, I love poetry.
Well, we have, gratefully, we have Sean, who is going to be doing some poetry in the next segment, and he also talks about, obviously, his mental health struggles and how that affects him in regards to poetry. So this is our next segment featuring Sean, and you're listening to Mentally Sound right here on Gravity Radio Northeast.
Okay, we're here today with Sean McDermott. Now, Sean, I've known you for a long time, but obviously our listeners won't know anything about you. So would you like to say a little bit about Are you keen to be in the mental health world?
Yes. I came to be in the mental health world, unfortunately, because of taking too many illicit drugs, not having an opportunity to fit into society, to fit into the working world, as I was often bullied at work, and unfortunately I became ill because of drugs and also because of being bullied, things like that, and fortunately, managed to recover from a chronic mental health problem. And since then, I've recovered from a mental health problem. I've actually been successful in work, in university teachings. Got a book published, which I'm going to recite a few poems from today. I'm in a band, and I'm also very fit. So, although I have had serious mental health problems, I've learned a lot from the mental health problems that I've had. Being able to put the knowledge and wisdom that I've learned from my mental health problems into good use to help other folk in the hospitals recover or stay out of hospital. And I've also learned a lot about human nature and society. And ironically, as it says on the appraisal of my poetry book, the introduction of my poetry book, that if I'd never become ill, I perhaps might not have been as creative as I am now, or even as successful as I am now.
Right, so that's a very interesting angle in terms of, in some ways your mental health problems have helped turn you into the person you are now, with your artistic skills and your desire to put something back and to help other people.
Yes, yes. The desire to contribute to society as a teenager was never there, and that was because I didn't like society, because I didn't have the opportunity, as I said before, to work or to fit in. But since I've had positive experiences, since I've had a mental health problem and recovered from a mental health problem with work and with people at work, people, professionals at work, carers and maybe it's the odd good nurse, it's helped us have a positive outlook on the system and the working world.
Fantastic. And I know that you've explored many artistic routes, so poetry is one string to your bow, but you're also a very keen musician.
One of the things that I didn't realise in the past about creative abilities and creative talent was the fact that it was quite difficult to understand reality and be connected to reality whilst being in what people might class as a world of my own, where I was very creative but perhaps I didn't understand reality. But now that I understand reality, I can take part in reality and I still have my creative abilities. So what's actually happened is I've learned to understand reality, society and the system and the working world. By doing that, I'm able to keep my sanity more and also keep my creative abilities going properly.
So is it fair to say you've kind of worked out a philosophy for life and living that works for you?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Worked out, that's correct, Alistair, very much so, yes.
Great, fantastic. Now, would you be so kind as to read us some good poetry, please?
Yeah. This poem's about recovering from a mental health problem. It's called Another Chance. The ideal world I wish to see, my thoughts tell me it's not to be. Where do they come from and what do they know? How to nurture a mind and grow. Sleepy eyes disguise what's within. Come on, son, carry on and don't give in. Your soul is tired and your body is thin, but you must try again and this time win. This also is another poem about recovering from a mental health problem as well. This one's actually called Recovery. You don't know what's right and wrong, you've lost the plot and you don't belong. Kindness and compassion can cure your mind, and then reality you can find. The life around you will help you more than a medical cure. So believe me when I say, there will soon be a brighter day.
Fantastic.
This is also another poem that explains how the recovery process can happen and what it means. It's called Transition to Reality. What I am thinking might not be real, explaining the way I don't want to feel. Answers might come, warm and kind, or a taste of reality I could find. Positive ideas are real and true, give me reasons for things to do. Give me freedom to a way unknown, as out of illness I have grown. So thank the world and the God above, we all can still believe in love. This poem's called Solitude. It's about the suffering that people with mental health problems have within their own homes. Inside walls of brick, alone and sick, the clock ticks the time away. I can't feel better, no matter what they say. Stricken with a burden, and I don't know why. All that's left is for me to try to look at the good all around. A positive outlook can be found.
So, returning to you, Sean, I know that you very much attribute your mental health problems to the use of drugs, and I think I'm right in saying that some of your poems cover that topic in terms of being a kind of cautionary tale or a warning.
Yes.
So, if you've got a poem you'd like to recite along those lines?
Yes. Yeah, it's called Blind Utopia. The sun shines through the window and dances on the floor. Just another reason for drugs to score. And then when it's over, you want more. Enticing you into a world unreal, so that you're not even sure how you feel. The dream ends and reality is so cold, but you can't say you were never told.
Now, Sean, I know that as well that much of your recovery has been based on having a solid circle of friends and people upon whom you can trust.
Yeah.
And you've covered that in some of your work as well. Would you like to read?
Yeah. This poem is called Getting Better. It's also a song of mine, which I have music to. It goes as follows. If you're feeling dead and there's too many thoughts in your head, don't forget there is also someone who will call on you. Getting better day by day, getting better day by day. If you're feeling low and you've got nowhere to go, there is one thing you should know. We love you so, we love you so. Getting better day by day, getting better day by day. Find a friend and talk things through. The past is gone, the future's new. There's always something you can do. Getting better day by day, getting better in your own way.
Thank you. That's quite profound in its own way, isn't it?
Yeah.
And would you say, or would it be fair to say that that's one of the major factors that keeps you well in social life?
Yeah. It very much the case that having friends and having a good social life keeps you well. You know, everybody needs to interact with people, and sadly, you know, when people can't interact with others, it can actually cause illness. And so when you have the opportunity to interact with other people, it can actually help you to recover.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's about having that kind of human contact, the human touch.
Yes.
Then do you think there's enough of that in services?
Yeah, well, it's been getting better gradually. The mental health system's become more humanistic, more service user led as well,
mm-hmm.
more considerate of the service users' needs, more understanding of the service users. I think particularly the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a lot of more people recovering these days than there has been in the past, and that's because of the advancements. There's been able to for people to see people as people, not as illnesses, to be able to, you know, listen to the service users, for service users to be treated like individuals. So it's a lot less clinical. The clinical model in the past didn't really solve any problems at all. But now you've got like people that are sold what they call the social model, more talking therapies, more activities, giving the opportunity to engage in life events, places to go, the confidence to know that you're okay, the confidence to know that you can fit in with society, that you can, you know, get your, what you call your personality back, or that you can recover, belong to society, belong to the system in a way. And also, the main thing I think with the recovery of me was knowing that you can fit in to society and the system, but also keep your own individuality.
So your own integrity.
Your own integrity. Yeah. Like you can fit in, you can fit in, but most importantly, you can fit in your own way. So by fitting in, you're able to keep your own, you can still keep your own identity and your own personality.
Right.
And that's one of the major things, because when you have a service user that decides to fit in, then what they're doing is proving them, you know, that they are capable and they can actually interact with other people.
Yeah.
And when, you know, service users can prove that they can, you know, work or take part in society and, you know, take part in social life, when they can prove they can do that, then it's actually proven to the medical staff and the hospitals and the nurses that they're actually there, capable of work and capable of fitting in life. And when they prove that they're capable of things like that, then staff sort of start to see people as being capable, and then therefore their threat is more capable, and then become more capable.
So it's like a virtuous circle. Yeah. Things just get better and better.
Yeah. Like, I mean, if you have like a service user who, you know, can't work or can't interact or can't look after himself, or doesn't want to for whatever reason, then the class is very incapable. But if you can try and prove to the medical staff in whatever way that you can that you are actually capable, then your mental health gradually improves.
Mm-hmm. And these are the messages that I know you very much emphasise when you do work at the universities.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that in future shows you'll be kind enough to come along again, and on those occasions maybe gift us with a little bit of your music.
Yes, that's all we'll do. Yes,
great. So that's lovely, and thank you very much, Sean McDermott, right, whose book is called The Game.
Thank you for listening, folks, and hopefully next time I'll be having a guitar with me to play some mellow chilled out songs.
Open your mind.
Gravity Radio, in association with Mental Health Northeast, brings you a radio show on the second Friday of every month. Mentally Sound, a unique community show focusing on a subject which affects all of us, will air 2 till 4 p.m. Mentally Sound will talk to people around the Northeast about mental health, exploding the myths, raising awareness, asking and answering the difficult questions, voices of hope, with music, poetry and stand-up comedy. Mentally Sound, on the second Friday of every month on Gravity Radio Northeast, in association with Mental Health Northeast.
Open your mind.
What do you think, Carol?
Just what you need on a dismal day like today, Friday the 13th. Everything's supposed to go wrong, but it's not.
For those that are interested to know, Brian Fallon is the lead singer of a band called Gaslight Anthem. That was from his acoustic album that the name escapes me, but
beautiful.
Find it. It's incredible. He's just genius. Also, he headlined and did at a hard rock festival with Bruce Springsteen. He's very often compared as like the next Bruce Springsteen, and he's amazing. I listen to him a lot. We just listened to Sean, who did all his poetry and stuff, and you were telling me during the break that you knew him. You know him quite well.
Yes,
like,
he's a genius. I love his poetry, and I love his singing. He also sings blues and jazz, and he plays acoustics as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes his own music and songs. He's very gifted.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, because, you know, I perform as well, and I find it interesting that sort of you get to, like, sort of mental health, and where the next segment actually is about comedy and mental health, but,
yeah.
I mean, do you think performing and stuff kind of helps in regards to...
Oh, indeed.
To dealing with mental health and whatnot? Have you had experiences of that?
Yeah, well, it helps me, because I like to sing, and I also like to paint, you know, I'm an artist. So, and seeing Sean's a different person when he starts singing, you know, and when he starts to recite his poem, and then he goes back into his quiet, sublime self. So it brings you out of yourself, and it's very therapeutic, you know, singing and telling jokes and what have you.
It's good for the soul, as they say, pretty much, yeah. Do you have sort of any experiences, because there was a story I was going to tell, and now we've got a little bit more time, I can tell it maybe, but do you have experiences with CBT at all? And for those who don't know, that's cognitive behavioural therapy. Have you ever
done
any?
No, I don't.
Because I always tell this story of I've dealt with cognitive behavioural therapy, and the story I always talk about is the Cherry Coke story, which is going to sound really ridiculous, but I've mentioned this on my podcast before. But basically, a lot of times with mental health, you can stack the shelf of negativity in terms of that you're making your moods even worse than it already is. And my example of that, which is what cognitive behavioural therapy helps you with, is I remember...
What is cognitive behavioural therapy? Isn't it making you more positive?
It's kind of basically teaching your brain and you to be aware of when you are, like I say, stacking the shelf in terms of being sort of self-critical and various other things like that. And this Cherry Coke story, I think, is humorous, but it also tells you really what it helps you with. Because, for example, there was one particular time when I went into work and I was having a particular bad day with my mental health issues. And I stacked the shelf in terms of I went to the supermarket. I was running late as it was because I didn't really want to go to work.
Yeah.
Picked up a Coke bottle that was like turned the wrong way, and then went to work and then realised I'd picked up the wrong one, and I absolutely detest Cherry Coke now. Now, the reason that sounds ridiculous is, the reason I like using that as an example is, on a normal day when mental health doesn't affect you, you can kind of laugh that off and kind of just say to people in the office, oh, look at me, I'm such a div, I just took Cherry Coke without even realising, does anyone want this? But yeah. I noticed about a minute into me being generally upset about what I'd just done, that I was stacking the shelf of negativity in terms of, I was taking an example of something that was really, you know, flippantly irrelevant and could happen on any normal day. Mm. You know, even people who don't have mental health, and I was making it worse by stacking it with how I already felt and going, that's why I'm a failure in life, and that's why people don't love me, and that's why this Cherry Coke represents all the evilness that I have. And it is.
I see where you're coming from, because I've done that myself.
Yeah, but that's what's great about cognitive behavioural therapy. I recommend for just, you know, in general, kind of teaching your brain not to constantly look at the negative aspect of things.
So
it's
it is
really good.
Positive, isn't it? It's sort of rechannel it down a positive lane.
Yeah, I mean, it takes a bit of time, and obviously when, you know, it's dealing with therapy as well, which some people can be really, you know, sort of against and feel, you know, that they're not. I know a good friend of mine who came up to me about with therapy and said, you know, should I do that? Is it me sort of being weak? And I'm like, no, not at all. Go and do it if you feel that's what you want to do.
And it takes a strong person to realise that they need therapy, doesn't it?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. I actually mentioned that there's next comedy segment, but that's the one after. But what we're going to... The reason I'm bringing up CBT is we have a clinical psychologist on the show actually doing a segment. That's pretty amazing. And he's actually talks about how CBT helps, but with OCD.
Yeah.
You ever experienced...
I know a bit about OCD. Because I know somebody with OCD.
We were talking about this in the break, weren't we, about how OCD kind of... very often people just assume they have it.
But
yeah, go on.
But there's all types of OCDs. Mm. You know, it comes in different alignments. Like the particular person I know keeps washing their hands. Mm-hmm. There's all types, and sometimes it's like a compulsive behaviour, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, I knew someone that used to go to the door, and before she went out the door, she had to spin round 10 times before she opened the door. Mm-hmm. So it's all types of behaviours that are built in, and you have to do it, basically.
There's misconceptions as well, because I remember having conversations with this, that apparently there's loads of people who do stuff like sleep on the same side of the bed and all that kind of stuff, and people constantly think that that's like, oh, I'm being obsessive about something, but it's not. It's like animal instinct. It's like, that's why I thought it was weird that I always slept facing where the door was, but apparently loads of people do that. I've constantly asked, since I found out about that and was comfortable talking to it, I've asked everybody, I'm like, do you sleep next to the door? Like, do you sleep and mention the door? So it's all...
Isn't it fun? And I sleep away from the door.
All right.
And facing a window.
But you notice that you do it, so maybe you do it deliberately.
Yes,
that's interesting.
I get quite knocked if I don't.
But anyway, enough about us, because we know we actually have a proper professional who can talk about this. But we have for this next segment, we have Nick Hartley, who is a clinical psychologist, and he's going to talk about how CBT can help with OCD, and talks to several people about that in this segment. So like I say, this is Nick Hartley, and you're listening to Mentally Sound right here on Gravity Radio Northeast.
Hello there. My name is Nick Hartley, and I'm a clinical psychologist working in Newcastle. It's a privilege to be part of this new radio show on Gravity Northeast, and in this series of segments over the next coming months, I'm looking forward to spending some time with you exploring some of the different services and therapies available for people with mental health difficulties. Today, we're going to look at a type of therapy which has become very popular in the research literature and also in the NHS. Cognitive Behavioural Therapy, or CBT. Specifically, we're going to think about how CBT can help those experiencing a type of difficulty that can occur with anxiety, a type of difficulty that's often called obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. And we'll spend some time today thinking about what we mean by that phrase. I'm joined by Leila Moffrad, a cognitive behavioural therapist who is based here in the Northeast. Leila, good to see you.
Thanks.
So today we're going to focus particularly on CBT for what we call OCD.
Yeah.
And thinking about what that means and what it is that's being offered to people when they come for help. How do we define the problem?
Yeah, sometimes it's quite difficult. I think sometimes people have a very specific idea about what OCD is, that it's specifically related to cleaning or contamination, and they might have seen that on the telly or heard people talk about it. But actually, it can present in lots and lots of different ways. Kind of checking behaviour or rituals or feeling like they have to count certain things. So the first thing is about working out if the problem sounds like OCD or not.
Because I suppose we all have different kinds of obsessions, don't we?
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose that's the thing about OCD is, in a way, it's a natural kind of behaviour or a natural kind of thinking process that everyone does, but for some people it's just more amplified and causes a problem in their everyday life, and it can feel like it's taken over a bit. But we're all kind of on the spectrum. I'm sure lots of people, like, I've had to return back to the house to check that I've switched my hair straighteners off. And, I know that I've done it. I know that I've turned them off, but I still have to go back and check. Yes. So, and I'm sure everyone could identify with that kind of thing.
Yes. And so I'm thinking about somebody who, and they might be listening to this at the moment, who's thinking about coming along to their GP to talk about these experiences and possibly thinking about seeing a therapist about it.
Mm-hmm.
When they come along to see a therapist like you, a CBT therapist, what kind of thing would they expect to find? What kind of work would they expect to be doing?
Well, the first couple of sessions is about working out if the problem is OCD. So we might do some questionnaires, some kind of generic questionnaires. We might do a questionnaire specifically about OCD. And that really helps us to find the range of different thoughts and behaviours that the person might be experiencing. And then the first few sessions are what we would call kind of formulation work, which is really about gathering information about some specific examples of the OCD. Mm-hmm. So I might be saying to someone, if your problem is about checking, say, light switches, for example, can you tell me when you last did it and how it felt and what kind of thoughts were going through your mind, exactly what you did, what you predicted would happen, those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd be trying to work out the pattern of the thoughts and the behaviours, and then trying to work out what's keeping the OCD going, so which thoughts and which behaviours are keeping it going, and then we can work out how we might break it after that.
Right. So in all cases, it sounds like you're saying there's a real importance in really understanding where someone is.
Yeah.
In terms of their anxiety and really understanding what's going on for that person individually and going at their pace as well.
Yeah, definitely. And for some people, that might be quite quick. For some people, if they've had OCD for their whole lives, then that's going to take quite, a bit of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to take us a while to work that out and to work out what the first step is.
Yeah. So there's some really interesting things that go on, isn't there, in OCD in terms of the way we think about our thoughts.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering whether there's any key messages it would be helpful to send out to anyone listening to this who's thinking about seeking help or coming into therapy.
People with OCD, it can make you have really unusual and kind of scary thoughts sometimes. and thoughts that you think that other people would never have had, and it could be about harming someone, something that's really distressing, and that can be really difficult to talk about. But actually, that's a really quite a typical experience.
And I think we can all be surprised, can't we, by how common some of those intrusive thoughts that we have are. And we can often find ourselves having some very strange, weird and wonderful thoughts when we're doing various things.
Yeah, people have loads of weird and wonderful thoughts, and I know there's something as well about being in kind of tense situations, like in a meeting or with a manager, and thinking like, what if I just swore out loud or just, you know, impulsively took my clothes off and ran around the room. Like, you know, there's lots of strange things that we all think, and it's quite normal to have those thoughts. Mm. It just, for some people, it can be very scary to have those thoughts.
Yeah. And it's when that distress is really high that it sounds like, to me, therapy then can be really useful and helpful in helping people understand what's going on and finding ways through that.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. Well, good to see you, Layla. Hopefully see you again soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me along.
Great. Take care.
Okay, bye.
And we'll hear from Robert about his experiences with CBT after this record. And so I'm now joined by Robert, who's experienced CBT for OCD. Good to see you, Robert.
I'm pleased to be here, yes, good.
So I was wondering if we could first talk about how you decided to seek therapy.
Well, I didn't. It was the crisis team. And the crisis team were called in to help, but realised that the condition was OCD, very, very crippling. And so they said, well, CBT is the way forward here.
And how did that feel when they explained that to you, when they put that to you?
I was just very pleased that finally there was some help being given.
And I'm wondering as well, how when they were talking about CBT, how did they describe what that was?
They were keen that I should know that it wasn't just counselling,
right,
that it was interventionists, it was hard work, and there'd be homework.
Right.
I would be expected to participate.
And so how did the therapy live up to your expectations?
It exceeded expectations. I had no idea what to expect. It was hard work. It dealt with the OCD, in my case, has more to do with years of very, very unpleasant, intrusive thoughts and images, which I believed. So the CBT was about dismantling that brick by brick by brick to reveal the real me underneath. So the CBT, in my case, was helping me realise that I wasn't bad, I wasn't horrible.
Mm.
They were just OCD thoughts.
Mm.
Thoughts are very important. The downside to that is that you tend to believe any rupture goes through your head.
Yes, the thoughts can be very powerful.
Yes. But it was so good just to have a CBT consultancy.
And I'm wondering about that process, Robert, about dismantling those thoughts, brick by brick, as you say. What was that process like? What did you do?
Well, you had a whiteboard.
Right.
So we'd pick individual areas which had been torturing me for years.
Mm.
We'd actually write from one particular thought, we'd then break it down, and the emotions that went with it, and link by link by link, using evidence to break them, so that I just stopped believing them eventually. They were great, very caring, very understanding.
Well, that's really good to hear. Yeah, I'm glad you've had a good experience.
Yes.
And I'm aware that there might be people listening to us right now and thinking that they might want to seek help for something like OCD.
Yes.
What would you say to them? Have you got any words of wisdom to give to them?
There were times when I was sitting in the waiting room and I thought, I knew we were going to be going into some really deep personal waters here.
Mm.
And I thought, oh God, this is going to be... And then I'll think to myself, man up for God's sake. Because it will take mettle. It'll test your mettle. You need personal courage to do this. If you want to get this problem sorted, you know, you're going to need... Be prepared for hard work. Mm. I'm talking about some very personal stuff.
So it sounds like you're saying it's not a decision to take lightly.
No.
And it's difficult to know when the right time is to seek therapy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think from my experience as a psychologist, what I would say is that that's a really helpful conversation to have with your GP or any other teams that you're involved in. And if you aren't sure whether it's the right time for therapy, being able to explore that with someone who knows you and knows your history can be a really helpful first step.
Absolutely, yes. But if you imagine being tortured by a single thought for days and days at a time where you think about nothing else, and it's an obnoxious thought, and you think that thought is telling you what you are, it's going to take a lot of dislodging.
Yes.
But even though at the end of it you realise that warts and all, ruckles and all, you're okay. And it's amazing that you've come through it with your sanity intact.
Mm.
I think that's a really positive message and a message of hope. So it's been really nice to meet you, Robert. Thank you for sharing your experiences. I hope that's been really helpful to people out there listening to the radio today.
I hope people can take something from that, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See you soon.
Thanks to Layla and to Robert for sharing their views and experiences about what we mean when we talk about CBT for OCD.
Were you ever being low down, worried and blue, Carol?
I've been low down.
Yeah, that makes me worried.
I did have blue lips this afternoon.
Oh, yeah, I know. Yeah, it's a shame you can't see. But yeah, Carol's sporting a very amazingly nice blue lipstick. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. Is that just random? Is that just like, let's go with it? Or do you just...
I wear lipstick and nails for Jenny to match.
All right, cool.
Whatever I'm wearing.
So it's just literally when you wake up, you're like, oh, I'm going to choose this.
Yes,
and
indeed.
From there. That's pretty cool. So yeah, what did you sort of think of that segment in particular? We played the music. That was Hugh Laurie. If anyone who wanted to know that of House fame, he did an album called Let Them Talk, which is what that album's from, and it's absolutely amazing. I highly recommend. Mm. You were saying you didn't even know he was a musician?
No, I didn't.
He's fantastic. He was at the Sage not too long ago as well, and I really wanted to go. Couldn't get anyone to go.
Pity I didn't know.
I know. Yeah. Well, next time you want to, I'll ask him around. Yeah, I'll ask him around. Yeah. But yeah, so that was great. A little bit more information about CBT and OCD and various other things. So it was really great. And I say that's a continuous series, so he's going to do more about that.
We were saying earlier that people are a bit uncomfortable about CBT.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to one of the other
managers
behind.
Yeah.
Her mother is a counsellor
and
likes counselling. And counsellors don't give advice, but people that do CBT give advice, don't they, and tell you. You know, try and change your way of thinking, so they have to give you advice.
Yeah, they literally tell you how you should do things, like sort of a self help book inside a human being. Is how I like to describe it. But it really is it's really helpful. I mean, I have bipolar disorder, and with that, there's a new form of CBT called DBT, which is a relatively new therapy, and that's more related to sort of emotional mood disorders, similar to what I have, because I have a very high bipolar disorder, in a very destructive one. So the problem with that, with it being a relatively, you know, retro, you know, new thing, is that there's a very sort of big waiting period for that. But you know, I think because a lot of people like myself end up getting on CBT, and it affects sort of the symptoms of what I go through, but it doesn't affect the cause, which is something a lot of people often misconstrue. But
how did it help you then?
CBT helped, like I said, in terms of, because a lot of people get CBT for like severe depression like a lot of depressive symptoms. CBT can really help, and depression is a byproduct of my bipolar disorder, so it helps in that sense. But like I say, it doesn't help to the root problem of why I feel the way I do. It just kind of helps me cope with it more, which you can only really do anyway. You can't ever be fully cured, but it wasn't, you know, helping me as much as something like DBT hopefully will. But like I say, with it being a relatively new form of treatment, it's the waiting list is even longer than it would be for a regular thing. I mean,
for at least, you know, it's available.
Yeah. I mean, how do you, like, if you mind me asking, like, how do you sort of, in a very sort of basic sense, or you can widen this as much as you want, but how do you sort of, is there any techniques you've come up with that kind of helps you deal with the stuff you go through?
Well, with my depression, I suffer with SAD, so I get quite...
Oh, the season, is that seasonal?
Seasonal dissociative disorder.
Yeah.
And I get very low when there's no sun. Even now, the sun's going, it's diminishing, so I can feel, you know, like the curtains are closing. I just want to crawl away like a little squirrel and sleep. But you can't. So how I cope is, I haven't got a light box. I did used to have one, but I tend to eat healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to find eating fish and vegetables and fruit helps me to cope with my depression, and obviously taking my medication.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think a lot of the time, whenever, you know, depression or any form of mental health comes up, it's always a case of what can you do physically, and as well as what you can do sort of through medication and various other things. And there's so many different ways of doing it that what I always say, and I only can speak for what I go through, but it's a bit like if you get 1,000 people into one room who have the same disorder or mental health issue, and you ask them how they treat it or cope with it, you'll get 1,000 different answers. Indeed. Because it's so trial and error.
That's why this programme is fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, definitely, yeah. I must mention as well, because we talked about this, but if you want to help us in terms of supporting this particular radio show, you can find us on Facebook at Mentally Sound. We have a group there. On Twitter, we are MHNE Tweets. That's at MHNE Tweets. And you can email us at mentallysound@gravityradionortheast.co.uk. If you want to email us now, we'll be... If there's any emails that we want to address, we'll look at that later in the show. Are you a comedy fan, Carol?
Yes, I like Jack D.
Jack D?
He looks serious, but he's really funny, isn't he?
I like his deadpan stuff, yeah. I always like... Do you ever see him on QR? He's always very...
Only a little bit.
Yeah, whenever he's not been on very much, but I was like, he's just like, he's just doesn't.
But I like the old stuff.
Respect, yeah.
Sorry to interrupt you then. I like the old stuff. I like the old stuff on TV, like Porridge.
Porridge? Yeah.
Open All Hours.
Yeah. Oh,
Mrs. Bouquet.
Oh, Open All Hours. I've lost respect for you now, Carol.
Oh, sorry.
Didn't they, am I right in thinking, didn't they bring that back?
Yes.
Oh, God.
It wasn't as good, though, was it?
Yeah, I'm not, wasn't, because it's like 40 years later, yeah. Whatever it is. It's like, what's going on? Like, yeah. I'm suddenly coming across as ageist, I apologise. But it's just, they always seem to be bringing back all the old stuff for, like, Christmas specials. Like,
yeah.
Although, when they brought the Royal Family, that was quite good. But anyway.
I like the Royal Family. I'm going to be controversial.
You don't like it?
No, I do like the Royal Family.
It's good. Yeah, I was going to say, when they brought it back for the Christmas specials, they're practically the only thing I ever watched, barring... obviously the huge geek that I am, Doctor Who, but apart from that. But the reason I'm bringing up comedy, though, is the next segment is with Sharon. It's really, which is what I interviewed her over on Skype, and I have to say, like, I should tell briefly, I think I mentioned this in the interview, but, like, I originally, like, met her in the comedy scene, like, sort of, I think, like, between 8 and 10 years ago, because it was during university, and it was interesting to catch up with her, because there was a lot of... there was hardly any female comedians around, and I know she was doing a comedy show at The Telegraph, I think, where it was just predominantly female comedians, because it was so scarce, and it's just interesting to get to talk to her about that, and obviously looking at comedy from a mental health angle. Do you think, sort of, that comedy includes women enough? Like, it never seems to me. I mean, there's a few on TV,
but... Something interesting happened this week, because we went to a programme called Laughing for Lassies on Wednesday at the Clooney, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, which is the showcase. Brilliant. Then. Well, that's what we were talking about, yeah, so was it good?
Cause it was excellent, it was packed, and it was a laugh a minute from start to end.
It sold out, apparently, yeah. It was really good. So that's great, so that's what we talked to Sharon about that, and how obviously the project came about, and all sorts of comedy-related stuff. So this next segment... is me and Sharon Race talking about the comedy and laughter for lasses and mental health all thrown in. So yeah, this is my interview with Sharon, and you're listening to Mentally Sound right here on Gravity Radio Northeast. Hello everyone, I'm here with Sharon Race, here to talk about her comedy workshops for our mental health show Mentally Sound here on Gravity Radio Northeast. And I'm delighted to say she's here joining me on Skype. Hello Sharon.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, how are you?
Yeah, not bad, not bad.
Kind of an appropriate thing to start with, how are you on a mental health show? Are you well?
Physically, no, fighting chest infections, but mentally very sound.
Yeah,
yes.
Excellent, yeah. So we're here with Sharon to talk about her comedy workshops and various other things. So, but before we start all that, can you just give a brief outline of what kind of stuff that you do, Sharon?
Yeah, I'm a Newcastle-based writer, producer, performer, always focusing on comedy performing, and basically I used to be a professional stand-up comedian. I got a bit fed up of the travelling and so on, which is a bit of a pain in the bum, getting back in the middle of the night, etc. But yeah, it's all good now, and starting to look to heal with humour, which is obviously always a good thing.
Yeah, actually, I've always wanted to ask you that with, you know, ask people like yourself this question of, do you really think laughter is sort of a form of medicine? Because everyone always kind of of says that sentence of going, oh, you know what you need? You need laughter in your life. Do you think there's some case for that to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been scientifically proven that laughter helps you physically because of the way you sort of your body reacts and the adrenaline and sort of obviously when you have big belly laughs, all of that helps your diaphragm, etc., etc. But obviously it's the mental health part of that is that it lifts your mood. So if you're feeling a bit down and a bit low, if you go meet a friend and have a few laughs over a cuppa, then you always feel 100% better. That's my opinion anyway, but it always seems that's the way that humour does heal.
Definitely.
And obviously there's things like ha-ha-ha workshops and so on, which I'm not necessarily advocating, but people can do whatever they want to have a laugh, so it's all good.
Yeah, and I mean, as you say, what's interesting about this sort of way that you're looking into it is that it's not just about the physical, you know, helpful things that it does, because obviously when people say when you laugh, obviously, you know, say that like it's an attractive quality as well, as that when you laugh you also like, you know, accentuate your facial muscles and everything else, and you laugh, you smile more and you seem more approachable and all that kind of thing. But yeah, it's interesting from a sort of mental perspective that, you know, that it can have some mental benefits as well,
because it releases the oxytocin, is it? Yeah. Don't want to sound like an ignoramus, but yeah, it releases things in your brain, doesn't
it? Imagine it's the endorphins. It'll raise your endorphin levels as well and various other things. And and another thing as well, if you're talking physical, I'm pretty sure it increases your sort of metabolism as well, so you can process things a lot quicker, you know, food-wise and whatnot. But so what in essence made you start these comedy workshops as Launchpad? Was it along those lines, or was it something different?
Well, basically Alistair Cameron and myself had a few meetings just to sort of discuss what possible projects we could look at doing, and this was one of the ideas, was focusing on women and women in comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea came about running workshops around stand-up comedy, and also just comedy writing, comedy performing, and then doing the workshops, culminating in a actual showcase where they would perform to an audience. So that's basically how it came about, and we were kindly sponsored, as it were, by the Community Foundation's Women's Fund, and they actually paid for the project to go ahead, which was brilliant.
How did they become involved in that? Was it something that you went to them and said, I've got this idea, or?
Yeah, it was just via their application process.
Okay.
So we just received the funding to go ahead with the project, which obviously it's all about, the project was about empowering women and empowering people who've had mental health issues. So the criteria for people to attend was that they'd been a survivor of mental health issues, or they'd... they were currently going through mental health issues, or they were supporters of mental health. So it was quite a wide criteria.
I was just about to ask that. Like, so is it mental health across the whole spectrum of mental health, or is it specific to? Because obviously you've got mental health issues that only women get. You know, obviously like postnatal depression and all that kind of stuff. And is it across the whole thing, or is it just? Is it gender specific, or is it just it doesn't
it
necessarily matter?
It was gender specific, yeah. Because of obviously the funding being the Women's Fund, we did want to focus, and we wanted to focus anyway on women anyway, because quite often obviously women are left out of the loop, especially for performing. And you know yourself, sort of female comedians, it's sort of the ratio is much more men to women. I've forgotten where I'm going with this. Sorry.
It was just about the sort of female angle of it being just female health issues and various other things.
With International Women's Day being last weekend, the show actually was to sort of celebrate International Women's Day as well. Great. So it sort of had a twofold effect with the mental health issues, empowering women, and then coming together to celebrate International Women's Day.
Yeah. Before we get on to, obviously, because we want to talk about your showcases, as we were recording this, it was last night, so I want to definitely talk to you about that. Last night was the day before, wasn't it? The 10th.
Yeah, Tuesday.
I wanted to quickly just ask you about, what do you think, because that's often a topic of conversation in regards to comedy in terms of females being involved in the actual profession. Like with the fact that when I originally, we were just talking about before this interview started, that we actually met on the comedy circuit, 10 yeah. years ago or something. And it was very scarce then. I mean, you were in a very small field of people I knew who were female comics.
Yeah.
Is the situation changed since then, or and if not, what do you think? Why is the current state of it like it is?
It sort of fluctuates. Sometimes there's lots of sort of people come out the woodwork, women come out the woodwork to try comedy. At the time when I was working professionally as a stand-up, I was actually just about the only one in Newcastle at the time. But then I started a women-only performers stand-up comedy club called Laughing Lasses, mm-hmm. and that got a lot of sort of women coming out of the woodwork who had always wanted to do comedy, but that didn't feel sort of that they could just go to any pub or club and get up and perform. So it was a nice safe environment for mm-hmm. them. But yeah, I mean, at the moment, female comics, there's a lot more female comics on TV. We see the likes of Sarah Millican, Miranda Hart, Josie Long, those type of people. Mm-hmm. So it is getting a lot better than it was sort of 10 years ago. Which is the main thing, because people are either funny, whether they're a man or a woman, or they're not.
Absolutely, definitely. I think what it comes down to, from what I've seen, I've read a lot about this. I always like Jimmy Carr's book about this, where yeah. he mentions in it that it basically comes down to, and you were sort of touching on this, is that from what it's worth, I think it's down to, like you mentioned, you're the only woman in one particular area, like in one comedy club, you're like the yeah. only woman. And the only other woman who's ever going to be there is like a girlfriend of a guy who's took her there, then it kind of yeah. makes an environment of just a male-dominated room. And you just feel like you can't, you know, be the Joe Brands and Josie Longs, like you say, where you can talk about sort of women, you know, women's issues, life in yeah. the process of a woman, and that's just right. not... You no one's going to go, well, you don't want to listen to that, because we're here that's to... Right. We're, you know, I can't obviously say this on community radio, but they want to
yeah.
talk about specific things. It's getting there with, like, certain other comedy clubs that are coming out where it's more like, oh, bring other people, and it's a little yeah. bit more like a friendlier environment. So I think it's getting there. But, yeah, as you said, yeah. there's some way to go.
Yeah, and there's the stand in Newcastle is particularly good, but yeah. the stand in all three of their venues, Glasgow and Edinburgh, they are very good, where they mix and match totally. And as I say, it's if you're funny, they book you. If you're not funny, they don't. So there you go.
Yeah, exactly. So you mentioned your comedy workshops and everything with the idea of having the showcase, which was on the 10th of March. Where was that and how did it go?
It was at Clooney 2 down in the Ouseburn.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a full house, which was brilliant. And lots of support, and some of the participants dropped out, which was a shame. But obviously that's just the way mental health goes. If you're having a bad day, the last thing you want to think about is getting up on stage in yeah. front of 60 people. And,
hardest thing in the world, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So some of the participants dropped out, but they were really the stars of the show. We had one of the girls actually headlining and closing the show, and she got sort of obviously the biggest applause.
Nice.
And our set was fantastic, and afterwards she just sort of said how empowered she felt and how it's boosted her confidence, and she just felt amazing. So another girl said that she was so devastated that it was over, the workshops and the performance.
Wow, that's really good. That shows that. That was going to be my next thing, because as you're talking about this, it clearly matters to you. Like, how does it feel from your perspective as someone who, you know, sort of helps people with mental health issues in that way?
Well, we're hoping to get funding to continue the work, which and look at expanding it so it's not just necessarily comedy, mm-hmm. So that people would be writing anything that they want to. As long as people are letting their creative juices out. Mm-hmm. So hopefully via Launchpad we'll be able to continue the good work.
Mm-hmm. How does it feel for you personally? Like, do you feel like fulfilled that you're helping people out with this kind of thing?
Yeah, for, on Tuesday, obviously the look on the girls' faces after they got the applause and so on, is that was obviously worth every moment of sort of worry and stress on the day. And it, as I say, it was all about empowering them. Myself came secondary to, when I was emceeing the actual event. It was all, the focus was on the girls.
Yeah.
And they did a brilliant job. So
yeah, that's always something. That's something I understand, because I, when I've ever hosted events and whatnot, and especially if I've like planned the whole thing, it's like, it's such, it's, it, it gives such a fulfillment of that you're showcasing people who you actually think are good. And actually getting the buzz of going, it's not about me, it's about showcasing the people who I think are good as well. And it just all comes across in such a positive way, and it's great that you're doing it. It's, it really is. So what if people want to get involved in these things, is it possible for them still to do that? And if so, how can they?
Well, this particular project, Laughter for Lasses, this project this time round is ended for now. We're going to be doing the evaluation, see what people's point of view were. And as I say, we're currently awaiting funding and for the next stage, which will hopefully be able to keep it going longer and incorporate more than just stand-up comedy.
Excellent. I think that's, well, I if you do obviously get more funding, please do let us know. And we'll, and you're welcome to be come back on. You must, before I go, I must say, you must, we must organise getting you on my podcast so we can have a longer conversation, because it's, I can imagine us having quite a lot to talk about. and it's X-rated. You can say what you want. But yeah, thank you so much for, but thank you so much, Sharon, for being on this, first show. Obviously, this is this is a, you know, sort of a trial and error. See how well we do. So, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me over Skype and then taking time out of your day. Apologies for all how difficult this has been to set up, but thank you so much for being a part of it, and good luck with everything in the future.
And with you. That's great.
Thanks. Absolutely. Adore that song. That was Gaslight Anthem with "Here Comes My Man," and I'm delighted to say in the studio we are joined by Kelly, our producer. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, are you alright?
I'm doing awesome. Even more so that you're here.
Well, you know, hey, it's been a great show so far.
Thanks, man.
Apart from all the technical difficulties that we've had. But
well, the advantage of that is we get a little extra time. So we're
because you're allowed to do that.
Yeah, cool. So we're going to have like a little mini interview and talk a little bit about you, if you're okay with that.
Yeah, that's fine. Funny,
Carol, do you have anything you want to
ask? Because I know you've had your own issues to deal with. I know you've had your own issues to deal with, Kelly. Do you mind telling me what some of those are?
No, not at all, actually. I actually have borderline personality disorder myself. I have OCD, and I also have slight autism, so yeah.
Which would you like to start with?
Oh, well, which one do you want to know about?
Borderline personality.
Sorry?
Borderline personality.
To tell you the truth, I don't actually have a very good understanding of it myself. I've kind of had to learn to cope with my own issues over a very long period of time.
Yeah.
I started counselling about 4 years ago, and to tell you the truth, before that, I didn't think there was anything wrong with me at all. I just thought I was, well, I kind of did always had an inkling there was something wrong, but I just didn't want to face up to it. You know, there was nothing really significant that it happened within my life that I thought I needed to deal with. You know, I did some terrible, terrible things in my time, but it was kind of just like, oh, well, that's happened, never mind, move on.
So having a diagnosis, do you think it's helped you?
I think because there's a stigma to mental health, and because there's now been a label put above my head, it is twice as hard to tell the truth.
Yeah.
You know, it has become twice as hard for me to move on from the past and into the future with it. You know.
So, you mentioned three things there,
three
categories.
I did,
which is the hardest for you to cope with on a daily
basis?
The
hardest? Oh, dear me. I would say all three, really, because obviously having three personality disorders, it's, well, it's three times the challenge, really, you know. So, yeah.
Yes, how do you cope with your OCD, for instance?
With my OCD? I have mental breakdowns every day over it, to tell you the truth.
I don't know if I knew well enough. I was going to joke and say you don't, I imagine.
No, I don't, actually. My OCD actually affects pretty much all my behavioural
my whole life, really. Yeah. You know, it's not just about cleaning. It's not just about, you know, washing your hands or certain ways how to make a bed or anything like that. It actually becomes a behavioural problem, and it can become very destructive as well. Yeah. Because if it's a bad behavioural problem, it's just a constant circle, you know. But some days, you know, I'm all right. I'm not too bad. I can cope with that. And then some days, I just don't want to get out of bed.
Yeah, I think we all feel like that from time to time. You know, you're entitled to. So thank you for that, Kelly.
No
I don't know if you've got any questions, Steve.
I don't really. It's just that. Well, do you ever use CBT and with your OCD? Because about the segment earlier on, I'm just interested to know if it's helpful.
All I've really done so far is talking therapy with a guy called Scott. Actually, he's actually my CPN, and he's absolutely fantastic. Before going to see Scott, I got a raw deal. Basically, there was a lot of people that were telling me that my behaviour was normal. And that it was perfectly acceptable. And I knew it wasn't. This guy's came along and went, well, actually, that is not acceptable. It is not normal. But we will try and help you with that. And he has. He's tried his best. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I'm kind of stubborn. And sometimes I don't want to accept the fact that some things are normal. And it is supposed to be like that.
Do you think there's an element of as well? Because I often ask this to people who have mental health issues like myself, is that, do you think there's an element of people sort of assume that you're okay with being, you know, having mental health issues? I always find that people, it's really bizarre that people, when you mention mental health, they go, well, at least now you know what's wrong. It doesn't seem to make that any easier. Like, I don't get it.
Do you know what it is? Just because you know, you've got a label above your head and people go, oh, well, you've got borderline personality or you've got bipolar. Yeah. Explain it to me, please. Somebody just tell me what this is and actually help me to understand it and help me move on from it. Because if you're kind of stuck in a rut and you haven't got a clue what you're doing, and, you know, and you've got some guy sitting in front of you or some woman sitting in front of you going, well, did you know this is normal? No, I had no idea this is normal.
There's plenty. You can even have, you know, when you have a doctor sort of shaking his shoulders going,
I have no idea. Yeah, exactly.
Good luck. There's the door.
I actually have had that before. You know, I went to see somebody a long time ago now. It's about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. I went there and asked for help. And he basically told me that he couldn't help me and there's the door. And when you go and you ask for help and you actually pick up the courage, it really annoys you. And you think, well, what was the point of me actually coming to see you then? If you've got no idea.
Do you ever think there's an element of, because I know a lot of people say that the hardest thing to do is admit you need help. Is that really, do you really think that is the, I'm asking both of you, is that really the thing that most you need to do, really? Because I honestly think, you know, I've had two serious breakdowns in my life, and I think both times what's significant is the thing that made me overcome both of them was finally going, I can't do this on my own, like, I need help.
You need to be humble, don't you, and acknowledging that you need help.
But it's also stubbornness as well, though.
I think what it was for me was I woke up 4 years ago and I wasn't myself at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'd become somebody very much unlike myself. Very much unlike myself. And when you get to that point and you know yourself that you need help, that's when things are going to get better.
I also think do you think there's an element of outside influence as well? If you have friends who say, for example, you don't feel like you're not acting the way you usually do. I think that was the last serious thing I had. It was that for me.
No, because everybody thought I was absolutely fine. I was absolutely normal. I got up one morning and my whole life had been turned upside down. I had a complete psychological breakdown, mental breakdown, physical breakdown. I just wasn't who I was. And it was like, okay, what on earth's going on? I was getting all these feelings for people I didn't want and stuff like that. And it was just like, oh, okay. So, yeah, everything I've known has literally just changed overnight. Oh, okay, then fine, yeah. And it wasn't fine because, it was horrendous.
It's weird that, yeah, because with my bipolar disorder, with my moods going the way they are, yeah, a lot of the time it's feelings as well. Like, I can have like intense feelings for someone, and then the next day, like, act like they never existed.
Yeah,
like,
I'm exactly the same. You know, I can look at somebody 1 minute and think, oh, I really, really, really love you, and then I look at them the next minute and go, I can't stand you. You know, I don't know what it is, why I don't like you right now, but I just know I intensely cannot stand you. And then the next minute I look at them again and go, actually, no, I do love you. It's just a constant, but I mean, my poor partner, I feel heartily sorry for her, you know, I mean, I really do.
I mean, does she, I mean, obviously I know this is quite a personal thing to ask, but like how supportive is your wife? Like, does she understand it?
I call her my wife, but she's not, she's just my girlfriend. That's just that's just like a pet nickname that I have for
As in, like, what guys do, though.
We've only actually been together for about 2-3 weeks now, but she's shown me more support over the past 2-3 weeks that I actually have in my whole entire life, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
And I know to some people that might sound very weird, but when you spend your whole life looking for somebody that is going to give you support, when that support does come along, it scares her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it scares you very much, shall we say.
She's
your soulmate.
Yeah, I know this.
So I take it she's your soulmate.
Come on,
will you change your mind next week?
No, well, I could change
what
my mind in the next half an hour, you know what I mean?
What you guys don't see is me miming a shovel right now.
See, straight away there, I'm kind of like, okay, I'm panicked now. Okay, I need to know. You know, this is what it does to you, you know. Mm-hmm. It's scary.
But yeah, I hope actually, you know, it's great to have you on, because it's great to have another perspective and to also see if anyone like wants to, you know, have the courage to. We obviously will treat this with the utmost respect. I think this type of show is always going to do that. But if you want to, you know, tell your own personal stories like we have, you know, and be open, as I say, you can be anonymous if you want. But if you want to contact us, it's mentallysound@gravityradionortheast.co.uk for the email, or you can, we have a Facebook page. You can post on that if you wish, or do the old-fashioned way, send a pigeon. And it might somehow reach you. But there's a window next to you.
I know, it's lovely and cool, actually. Carol, I hear that you're very much interested in music.
Yes, I am indeed. I love singing. Ooh. I love singing jazz, pop. I do a lot of singing.
Ah, that's awesome.
Especially in the bath.
Oh, well, of course, you've got to sing in the bath.
Loud.
Yeah. Do you ever do karaoke, or like professional singing or anything like that?
I sang at a centre in Newcastle called Nagas, where I do my art, and they've got their own music room and music studio, so I sing there with the mics.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we have a jam on a Tuesday, so that's quite
interesting.
That's
awesome. That's really good, actually.
How are you guys for films? Are you film fans?
I am, actually. I'm quite a big film fan, yeah.
What kind of stuff do you like?
A bit of everything, actually. I'm quite diverse when it comes to films and music and stuff like that, you know. I do like horror films, but it depends on what mood I'm in, you know, because if I'm in the house on my own, I am actually a big wuss.
Yeah.
Now, you know, if anybody's listening to this that knows me, they will not believe that, but I actually am, because I actually come across, when I'm outside, as quite a tough, tough person. And I'm not really, you know, I'm actually a really big softie at heart.
Centre.
I am actually, yeah.
I like sci-fi.
Sci-fi?
I know. Vanilla Sky.
Are you, Vanilla Sky, wow.
Beautiful film.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, actually, as a byproduct, because I'm wearing a Star Wars t-shirt. Are you excited for the new Star Wars stuff?
Yes, I do.
I am, actually. I'm really excited to go and see it, because I've heard it's coming out in December.
Yeah, towards the end of this year, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you kind of like, I don't know, this blew up when they announced it, but are you excited about the old guys returning? Like, I say that.
No, not really.
Flippantly. Not really. Why do you say that, Carol?
I think they should just refresh it, because it was a long time ago.
Reboot it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean,
I am kind of excited that, you know, some of the old cast is coming back
it's like your conscience.
It's like the good and bad, isn't it? Like, you know,
she's the devil. No, you shouldn't.
No, bless her. No, she's just got her own opinions. You know,
it's all good. I mean, I'm such a geek about this that I wouldn't care if they just walked in and did an ensemble cameo or something. Like, I really couldn't care.
Yeah,
like I'm just really happy that I'm really happy. I guess if you're a consumer of stuff like we all are, it's good that. Good that like we get the opportunity to see this again. Like, I'm just happy they're redoing it, you know.
I like the first couple of them.
I love the Star Wars.
I do love Star Wars, but I just don't think they should bring him back.
They only made three up to now, haven't they?
I think that's enough. They should have stopped there then. That's quite enough.
Yeah, they've made three new ones, but, you know, there is the originals as well.
Really?
So, yeah.
Well, I refuse to acknowledge that new ones even exist.
Oh, no, you see, I absolutely love the new ones as well. I do, actually. Yeah, I think the guy that
through Phantom Menace, maybe. But...
The guy that actually plays Darth Vader, I think he's absolutely fantastic. I think he did a very, very good job at portraying Darth Vader, actually.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Well, you're entitled to disagree with me.
I will.
Yeah, yeah. And I see your point. I mean, it was well made and everything. Great people in it. It missed something from the originals. But maybe it was just the era it was made in. I don't know. I mean, you're talking
stick
late.
To the old.
Yeah, the old ones are always the best. Yeah, yeah.
But don't revamp them later on and bring the old cast in there, because that's just... No.
But I suppose
I'm right.
But on behalf of everyone who's like involved in this show and all the segments that have been done, like a huge thank you for producing this.
No problem.
And obviously, we look forward to a working relationship with yourself.
No, I'd actually like to thank Danny as well for this afternoon, because bless him, he's worked very hard to get the show back on air because everything crashed earlier on, and I must admit, I was in total panic. So yeah.
I think I said 2 minutes till it starts, and then...
yeah, that was quite scary, but we've managed to get it back on air, and I'm hoping everybody's enjoying what they're hearing.
It's gone smoothly.
It certainly has. One of the things I must do, because the next segment is about films, which is why I got onto films, because it's about mental health in films and how predominant it is. It's actually more so than you think, And Victoria and Wayne talk about, in particular, which I kind of put a theme music to it, so I don't want to say what it is, but it's pretty obvious. But before I do that, I want to do a little shout-out.
Oh, right.
Because Victoria has asked that we mention her kids.
Who are
apparently, I'm assuming they're listening.
Yeah.
So our big, huge shout-out to Jack Connor. Is it Michael? Yeah. Victoria loves you very much, and she wants to give you a big shout out for listening. So, yeah. And honestly, having edited this show, this segment's awesome. So you should be really proud of us. It's really good. This next segment. But actually, before I should say that, thank you so much for sitting down.
No problem, and thank you for joining me.
Yeah, it's quite welcome. This next segment is with Vicky and Wayne talking about a certain fictitious character. But I'll leave it at that. And you're listening to Mentally Sound right here on Gravity Radio North East.
We're going to be doing a series of programmes discussing mental health in relation to film. And one of the reasons that we chose film is because it is a really good medium for sharing ideas and for putting ideas across to an audience in a really accessible way. And you would actually be surprised quite how often mental illness is found in film, particularly mainstream film.
Yes, absolutely. Well, today we've decided to look at something that is as universal and is as encompassing as possible to introduce you to this section. And for that reason, it's more the film and the character of Batman. And bearing in mind that, yes, indeed, Adam West did star in a very dodgy made-for-TV film in 1966-67, the original Batman film that we have all, in the last generation, come to sort of know and love is Tim Burton's 1989 masterpiece, Batman. And it's really from this film onwards that we concentrate today on our look of this character and, indeed, the question of what's the matter with Batman?
And Batman is an extremely complex character to begin with. I mean, there are plenty of others we could have looked at, Tony Stark and Iron Man, but Batman in particular we've gone with because of the sheer variety of potential mental illness that we can associate with this character, who is not a victim, who is not a villain, but is in fact the hero and the lead agency in his own series of films.
Is Bruce Wayne the hidden identity or the identity in the open of Batman, or is Batman actually the hidden identity? And if you look at it from that perspective, you could say that actually Bruce Wayne is the facade and Batman is as real as the person that you're seeing will ever be.
Definitely. I mean, split personality is certainly... a mental issue that we can touch on with relation to Batman right from the beginning, because he goes to great lengths to hide who he is, not just in the Batman persona with the donning of the mask, but also with his portrayal, particularly in the Christopher Nolan films, as Bruce Wayne when he is in private and Bruce Wayne when he's in public, which is something I think we can all relate to, not even in a mental illness capacity, but simply how we behave when we are in public versus how we feel we can behave when we're just being ourselves. And Bruce Wayne feels, particularly in the Christopher Nolan films, I feel it's emphasised that he has to put on this playboy persona, this over-the-top, this overconfident persona to completely detract from who he really is. Now, do you think that hides a level of insecurity, not including the Batman persona, but in the two facades of Bruce Wayne?
Yeah, I think definitely. One of the perks of this assignment was allowing me to go back and look at, in detail, some of the last few motion pictures involving Batman and the different characters who played them. And I say Batman stroke Bruce Wayne. And I am, of course, talking about specifically Michael Keaton, Val Kilmer, George Clooney, and indeed Christian Bale. And what allowed me to sort of first focus on was, as you say, in private, their portrayal of Bruce Wayne and Batman. And I think that the two most similar actors, Keaton's portrayal of Bruce Wayne is extraordinarily different from his portrayal of Batman, in the same way that Bale's portrayal of Bruce Wayne is very different from Batman. And then equally, Val Kilmer and George Clooney's portrayal of the characters are very similar, but they are indeed massively different from Keaton and Bale. It seems that Bruce Wayne is the facade and Batman is the real expression of the individual. And in the other sense, it actually seems almost that Bruce Wayne is the real guy and Batman is just something to kind of balance the scales.
Almost more like a hobby in those middle films starring Val Kilmer and
George Clooney.
That's yes, thank you.
That's all right.
I think as well the big thing that you can notice is the physical transformation, not just with the donning of the costume, but in terms of changing the voice.
Yes, yeah, definitely. That's an interesting one, because by masking the voice, it's like taking on a different persona. And there is a sort of sense of kinsmanship in that. But when you do it on your own, you're also doing it because, in a way, you want to kind of become that different person and sort of say, well, I want to look at who I am and look at what I could achieve and kind of separate that.
I think the interesting thing as well is when you look at the splitting of the personalities, because you do have those superheroes who are happy to admit who they are. And again, going back to my example of Tony Stark, Iron Man, within the cinematic universe, the world knows who he is. Batman keeps that very private.
Yes.
And I think there are those people perhaps who are suffering through personal trauma, through personal issues, might be mental health problems, who do keep that hidden. And they do put forward this perhaps overly confident, perhaps overly public persona, whereas in private they are someone completely different. And it's as much to protect those people that they love, not necessarily in the real world from supervillains, but to perhaps protect them from the pain and the harm of seeing that person put themselves in a vulnerable and potentially dangerous place. But moving on a bit from the split personality aspect, looking at perhaps what made Batman Batman, the idea of grief, bereavement, post-traumatic stress and loss, which obviously comes from the murder of his parents, which he witnesses.
Of course.
Throughout the films, they've maintained that as a very key part of who the character is, despite the fact that they've made other changes to circumstances, villains, to plot, in order to keep up with the times. That has been completely consistent. Why do you think that loss and the witnessing of that loss is so important to the Batman character?
I think it helps establish two things. First of all, it helps establish a mindset. It's an unspeakable horror. He's not away at boarding school when this happens. He's not in his 20s. He is, depending on what you look at, between 8 and 12. And that kind of loss is very mentally crushing at a very sort of pivotal developmental age anyway. And I think as well as that, there is also the very strong fact that it also helps to define the person he later becomes and the world he lives in. It helps to define the relationships he has with people, and indeed, more specifically, the lack of relationships and the professional distance that he keeps from people. You know, this idea of sort of maintaining a professional distance and looking at it that way.
I think that's kind of hitting on the nature versus nurture debate, that the fact that that is a constant in his life, that one trauma, it seems to be a catalyst, but I think what really hits on something that people can relate to is quite often victims of trauma or abuse or anything that's impacted upon their lives. It's okay years later to still be feeling the effects of that.
Yes,
I think that's what speaks to the audience about Batman.
Well, definitely as well. And there's also a very strong sort of message when you look at the likes of Alfred, who is present in all of the Batman universes. And Alfred is a good friend of Batman's father and doesn't have to, but willingly becomes the boy's legal guardian and raises Bruce Wayne essentially as if he was his son. And at the end of the Dark Knight Rises trilogy, it's almost as Alfred's conclusion is the most touching, because Alfred himself wants to see Bruce Wayne effectively lead what I suppose you would say is a stereotypical normal life, or lead a very, that he wants there to be a happy ending, and that's a great thing. But I think that it's also a strong message that even though there are those who sort of put themselves out there and say, you know, you've suffered a loss, I will be there to support you and I will help you, there is, you know, there is still obviously going to be a residual effect there. And more importantly, there are other things in Batman's personality. It's not simply the death of his parents. There are other things which drive him to do what he does. And perhaps a lot of that has to do with the ideals of his father, who was also, as depicted in most of the universes, a strong philanthropist and believed very much in Gotham and the world that he inhabited. And very much in that sense that Batman sort of, you know, is driven not only by the loss of his parents, but is also driven by preserving memory and preserving legacy in that respect.
Do you think that when you consider the fact that obviously throughout the films he does seek some sort of relations, particularly with women, that, you know, perhaps there is a level of obsessionalism, perhaps OCD almost, about being Batman? You know,
yeah,
to
a large,
go out and repeat again and again this cycle of, I must go and help these people, I must go and rescue Gotham, I must pick up this particular criminal, because if I don't, something terrible will happen. And it's taking that whole, not necessarily intended ego trip, but that fact that it's all on him, it's all his responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I think that there is a big kind of, there's a big gulf there, because you're looking at somebody who essentially loves his city. You know, he wants to be the defender, he wants to be the White Knight. And then you see the Bruce Wayne character in other incarnations, Christian Bale and Michael Keaton both make reference to the fact that the Batman is a menace and should not be there. He's not an elected official, and that they need someone. And it's almost as if Batman is attempting, in a way, the Batman character is this individual's attempt to kind of force Gotham to look at itself and say, you know, you need to do the right thing. Because in every incarnation of the world in which he lives in, the argument is that Gotham is a very dark and dirty place full of crime, and that the essentially it's like, I mean, to use a biblical term, it's almost like the earth before the floods, you know, when that the world has descended into madness and it's descended into hell. So in that respect, I think that it's an interesting one. I think it also raises a strong point of, well, how abnormal is Batman in the abnormal world in which he lives? Is he simply trying to deal with as much as he can and sort of strive as much as he can to help his world, Or is he indeed someone who suffers greatly with personal loss and feels just neglected by the world in which he lives?
I mean, that's certainly a very interesting point, because when you talk about neglect, I mean, he is a lonely billionaire. Even
yes.
when he is
yes.
in full swing in the Bruce Wayne persona and attending the parties, he's got his mind on other things. He's thinking about saving Gotham. And I think you can make an argument about, does he truly enjoy that? Does he have anger issues? Is he a violent person at heart who enjoys going out and using that energy? Or is it because he feels the burden that he has to, because if he doesn't, then everything could all go wrong and it would be his fault almost? I definitely feel that the grief, the bereavement, the post-traumatic stress, the loss, I think all of that certainly is key to who Batman is. I
mm-hmm.
think when you look at the fact that it's included in all the films, when you look at just the profound effect that it has in that it's always used in flashbacks, that I think partly the reason that he wants to save the city is he doesn't want that to happen to anybody else. And
mm-hmm.
I think that portrays Batman as rather an empathetic character in some senses, which I think probably hints to me that it's not so much an ego trip to be Batman. He's doing it out of empathy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely. And I think there's a lot of that. There's a lot of empathy on his side in terms of what he wants to do. He thoroughly believes that what he's going to do will kind of change things for the better. And that, again, is something that, you know, can be identified with when we look at people who themselves display mental illness. There's a great willingness to believe that what they are doing will change things for the better. Some ways it can be very blinded, because you can look at Batman and you could say, well, actually, you know, what Batman is doing, he's very much blinded by the end goal and sort of can't really see what's in the middle ground. And in those terms, it can be argued in several places in the film that Batman takes actions which actually further his own interest and which don't indeed further anybody else's agenda other than himself. And that in itself is an interesting one, because he is displaying very much, yes, he's has the right idea and he knows the end result and it's a positive step, but indeed, is he doing it for the right reasons?
I think taking it down a slightly controversial route, what about Batman as potentially a self-harming character, that he is setting himself up to take a beating in some ways? Yes, it might be in the pursuit of preventing a crime, but particularly when you look at the Christian Bale, which are slightly darker, more serious in tone, you look at the self-punishment that he's putting himself through and how on numerous occasions he has an opportunity to get out of that, and yet still he physically pushes his body, damages the cartilage in his knee by continuing on and on with this crusade. Do you think he's doing it without regard for his health, or do you think he intentionally puts his health at risk?
I think he's definitely doing it without regard to his health. I think, especially during the Christian Bale films, there are several references. There's one when he goes to see a doctor and he's told, for a man his age, he has an unbelievable amount of fractures and wounds which have never been treated properly, because naturally, had they have been treated properly, he would have, you know, obviously been undergone several surgeries and treatments which would be too high profile. So I think in that respect, I think, yes, there is definitely an argument to support the self-harm in that respect, that certainly if he wants the beatings for a reason of almost dealing with the pain or allowing the frustration to have a physical form, then that's very true. I think we're in danger of running over time. I think we're coming to the end, but it's an interesting discussion, and one which I personally hope will encourage you to think about it yourself out there.
Oh, definitely. In relation to any characters that you happen to see in the cinema, even if they're not directly related to mental health, I think
mm-hmm.
it's very interesting to just sit down and analyse and interpret and look at the psyche of those characters and what makes them who they are, both their history and who they are currently. So I want to thank you very much for listening.
Hello everyone, welcome back to Mentally Sound. We're back here in the studio live, And I'm here with Carol, as per usual. Huge thank you to Kelly for being part of that show. I don't know what that whistle was about, but you might have heard it. it's nice to know I'm appreciated. but yeah, so huge thank you to Kelly. And also, you were mentioning during the last break about about wanting to... A few thank yous, we may as well mention that now.
Oh, yes, I would indeed. Oh, huge... Thank you.
So yeah, I don't know what that was, but sorry, apologies if you heard that. I don't know what that was, but it was some sort of crash.
A huge thank you to Victoria.
Yeah, obviously, definitely. Thank you for that segment as well. It was awesome.
Managed us all, and a lovely thank you to Gareth. He's also in the room. He managed the whole team and put a lot of this together, and Alistair Cameron that helped him as well. A launchpad. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we should mention, if you don't know how this all got involved, it's mainly down to Mental Health Northeast, which is what Gareth is part of. If you want to follow, make sure you do, like, sort of, if you want to support the show by obviously going on Facebook. We have a Mentally Sound group, and also we're on Twitter, at MHNETweets is the Twitter handle. And just... obviously, if you can let people know about this show, because obviously it's completely brand new. But yeah, huge thank you to Gareth and Mental Health Northeast for involving us in this, really, and getting the opportunity to do this. It's really great.
Quite special, really, isn't it?
But yeah, so we were just having this segment about, are you a superhero fan? Because they were talking about Batman during that.
I like Batman, but I'm a Superman fan.
Superman fan. All right, cool. So I'm assuming then, with the upcoming... You know, them two colliding. Are you rooting for Superman then, I take it?
It'd be Superman.
Yeah, that makes sense. Are you a fan? Which Superman? There's been so many variations of films. Have you got any in particular? She's deep in
his name now, the first one.
Christopher Reeve?
Yeah, he was my favourite.
That was cool.
Nobody's ever come
toxic,
close.
Do you think? I think
in looks as well.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we all kind of grew up with that version, so I kind of understand what you mean. Like, it was pretty awesome. Has to be said. We also should mention just anyone who's been involved in any of the segments that's been done. Huge thank you to everyone, because I mean, you have no idea. I want to like be stringently aware of everyone who's listening to this, to be aware of this, is that the amount of effort that's gone into all the segments that you've heard in this show. And obviously the plan is us to do this monthly, maybe even fortnightly, and the amount of effort that's gone into this is great. So anyone who's helped during this, the list is a mile long, but yeah, Alistair deserves credit, Gareth, Victoria, Kelly, all the guys from Gravity.
All the chaps that did the interviews, thank you very much.
All the interviews that were done. Obviously, we've still got more stuff to come. We've got Peter, Black Dog Runner, is going to come on with his segment a little bit later, and we've got the blogging segment coming up. Are you a blogger? That's something I wanted to ask
you. No, it's something I wanted to get into, but I haven't had the time, but maybe in the near future.
Are you one of these people, because anytime I ever talk to performers or anyone who writes poetry and stuff, are you someone like me who writes a lot? Do you write down stuff?
I write an awful lot, but it's only for my eyes only. So
okay.
But I am writing a book.
Tell us about it.
It's about me and where I've come from and what I'm doing and where I'm going. So I'll tell you more about that in the future, because I've only done about 3 chapters so far.
Cool. I'm writing a book at the minute as well, but I mean, it's nothing... as profound as that.
It's not an autobiography.
No, it's a sci-fi thing that I've been writing for a while, and I'm like really treating it seriously. Like I'm really like trying to come with all this sort of, you know, coming up with every angle. And
sci-fi, don't you?
I'm obsessed with it. So yeah, I mean, someone who has the Star Trek Voyager logo on his body.
Yes,
I think it's a sci-fi fan.
So your right arm or your left arm?
Left arm. Yeah, yes. I'm showing her it now. But yeah, so I'm a little bit. If you want to follow me on Twitter, actually, I should have mentioned that I'm at geek_apocalypse, which is also the name of my podcast. Free plugging. I'm plugging. That's appalling of me. but yeah. So I'm a huge geek, everyone knows that. This next segment we're going to do is a really really great one by Sophie, who's going to be talking about, which is good for you if you want to blog, talking about blogging and
tips.
Get some tips about it and everything. So yeah, this is Sophie and Ricky talking about blogging and blogging about all sorts of things, including mental health. So this is Sophie and Ricky. And I'll just... For some reason, I didn't put it up, so I'm just wasting time. Carol, are you good?
Yes, I'm okay. I know Ricky is quite an interesting person. He does design, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. It's a really good segment. Sorry, if for some reason I didn't put it up. I'm so prepared. But yeah, this is the segment now, yeah.
You're listening to Mentally Sound, my new show on Gravity Northeast. My name's Ricky. I'm a mental health awareness campaigner. With me is Sophie, who's a social work student at Sutton University. She's also a blogger and a carer. So, Sophie, tell me, from your perspective, what is blogging?
Blogging is an online diary. It's normally personal to an individual or a group. It normally contains a person or people's thoughts, ideas and opinions on one subject or a few subjects. Unless you make it private, only those who follow your blog can read it. Mm-hmm. And posts can be shared with readers on an international scale. Mm-hmm. Many people share their experiences and show their passions as well in a blog. Mm-hmm. And it's also a type of social media. And social media is just basically communicating online. Mm-hmm. And you can also insert videos and pictures into a blog.
Mm-hmm. And tell me, how did you get into it?
I started blogging because I felt that there was a gap in the market. I was applying for my social work degree at the time, and I was looking for advice on interviews, but I couldn't actually find anything. Mm-hmm. So then I set the blog initially to give advice, mm-hmm. And then I changed the purpose of my blog to include my thoughts and opinions on mm-hmm. subjects. And I now blog to share my reviews on TV programmes, books, mm-hmm. films related to health and social care. And I also document what it's like to be a social work student and a carer. And I've also featured posts on my mental health as well, mm-hmm. because I find it really therapeutic.
Yeah. So in terms of blogging itself, how would one go about it, and what tips can you give?
Well, first you need to sign up to a website such as Tumblr, mm-hmm. WordPress or Twitter. Take a look at all three, though. I personally use WordPress because I find it really easy. It's free as well, so you sign up, so you need an email address, a username, and other things as well, and then once that's done, you're good to go. Mm-hmm. Tips, I would definitely say start slowly. Don't rush ahead. Mm-hmm. Pick a day for uploading a post or posts. Mine's Sunday. Mm. Also, limit the amount of posts you do a week. You don't want to overload yourself because at the end of the day, blogging should be fun.
So it's important to pace yourself, yeah?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Mm. And also think before you post as well. Okay. What you're writing, you need to be comfortable with other people reading that. Mm. And also have blog ideas.
Yeah.
I'll keep a little book with me all the time, so if I get an idea, it goes straight down in the book. And also, don't be afraid to stray away from topic once in a while. Once you build up an audience, they're going to get bored of reading the same thing all the time. So think about what your audience want and then give it to them.
And as a last thing, why should people blog, and describe how important it is to you?
It increases your writing skills because you're having to write for an audience. You're obviously adapting your language and your writing style, and it helps you get your thoughts and ideas onto paper, which is obviously important when you're a student. It's a free thinking communication as well, so you can write what you want, how you want, when you want. It allows you to think deeper about your subject as well, and it allows you to look from various angles. It develops your other skills as well, so your commitment, time management, definitely your confidence, and your determination and a lot more, which are obviously valuable skills in life. It's therapeutic, as I said before. It allows you to release your emotions, and I found that on many occasions. It lets you release your inner thoughts and your feelings, because obviously a problem shared is a problem halved. And if you share an idea, it allows you to see if it's going to work or not. It helps you to network. It helps you meet other people with the same interests or the same thoughts and ideas. I've actually frequently been told that people know me from my blog. And when you hear that people have read your blog, it really develops your confidence dramatically. Another thing, you can inspire others. I was recently told that my blog inspired someone else to blog and it helped them to carry on where with their life. And maybe you could evoke that feeling in someone else because it's absolutely wonderful. It's free and doesn't take up a lot of your time. Mm-hmm. You can control how long it takes. It can evoke passions that you maybe never knew you had. I knew that I had a passion for English, and I forgot about that when I went to college to study health and social. But you could realise that you like a subject a lot more than you thought you did. It can create opportunities and it'll help you with other social media. And probably lastly, you may realise that you're good at it and might actually win an award. So.
And going back to the word inspiring, because it's a word we like to use in mental health. I mean, if you inspire just that one other person, it makes it all worthwhile.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely, yeah.
Excellent. Thanks very much, Sophie. We'll hope to hear from you again in the near future.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Open your mind.
Gravity Radio, in association with Mental Health North East, brings you a radio show on the second Friday of every month. Mentally Sound, a unique community show focusing on a subject which affects all of us, will air 2 till 4pm. Mentally Sound will talk to people around the North East about mental health, exploding the myths, raising awareness, asking and answering the difficult questions, voices of hope, with music, poetry and stand-up comedy. Mentally Sound on the second Friday of every month on Gravity Radio North East in association with Mental Health North East.
Open your mind.
Welcome back to Mentally Sound here on Gravity Radio North East. That was Red Hot Chili Peppers with Wet Sand from their album Stadium Arcadium. I decided to be all literally like a radio presenter there. I literally thought I'd do the whole radio voice and everything. In terms of blogging, is that something you're going to try at some point, Carol?
If I get some time, yeah.
Would you blog about everything or just...?
Mainly about my work, and I'm really into mental health. I'm doing a degree in mental health, so, you know, I'd blog about
I was going to mention to you, because the next segment is about being a student. I know through emailing me, are you at university at the minute?
Yes.
What are you doing?
I'm doing health and social care BA, so...
Mm-hmm. In my, how's that going?
Year. It's very difficult, because don't forget, I've got mental health issues, so this year's been the hardest, because I haven't been well.
I'm managing
good for
you, good for you. Do you get any help through the university, or
no,
anything like that? Or?
Not with the Open University, you don't. Mm-hmm. You do have, you know, what they like away days, but those are about every 2 months, 2-3 months. It's not, you don't really, you're just sort of really left, really. But you have got... a tutor that you can talk to whenever you need online, and you do have student support. So, because I'm disabled, I've got disability support as well, and that's really good.
Yeah, I mean, because one of the next segment coming up actually is just in reference to being, you know, a student and suffering mental health, which is obviously
very difficult.
Because I mean, one of the things that I am trying to, you know, sort of advocate to be people to be more aware of it, I think it would be beneficial for mental health to be treated more seriously before university. It seems that you just kind of get thrown into university life and then mental health's not really, you know, I make this argument that it should be like sex education and that it should be taught
from young age,
from the beginning. Because, you know, because it's like anything, if you're aware of it before you ever need to be aware of it, that's much more useful than finding out after the fact and not knowing how you're going through something.
Well, you can't bend the tree once it's grown, can you?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Can't prove it's
too late.
Yeah,
it's all interesting. So what got you, can I ask, like, because I'm just intrigued now, to, like, what got you, you know, did you just decide to go to Open University? What made you decide to do it?
I wanted to do it for 10 years, and there was just so many issues going on, and I applied actually 8 times. And then I thought, this is it, I'm at the right place. I've worked through a lot of my issues and had great support at the time where I was living, and I just got on with it. And I wanted to change my course in life. I wanted to become a psychologist, so that's what I'm doing.
Excellent. Well, I know we're sort of pressed for time, because one of the things we're on a bit later, obviously, due to the technical difficulties and whatnot. But if you do want to email us while we're still here, we're going to be here for the next 15 minutes or so. You can email us at mentallysound@gravityradionortheast.co.uk. But like I say, we have Peter and Becky. Peter is more known as Black Dog Runner, which I think is such a cool name. I really wish I had a name like that. Like, it's just a thing to be known for. Do you know why he's called that, Carol, at all? Have you heard of him before?
Heard of him before, but I can't remember why he's called that. I think he's got an image of a black dog, hasn't he, that follows him around?
Yeah, he mentions it in the piece, but yeah, it's really interesting. He'll mention it in the introduction, but it's just...
I think I remember it.
Okay,
now.
Cool. Well, I'll ease that burden on you, and we'll actually play the thing. But yeah, so this is Black Dog Runner talking about being a student with Becky, and it's a really good one, so please stick around and listen. What's wrong with my mouse?
Hello, you are listening to Mentally Sound, the new mental health radio show hosted by Gravity Radio Northeast. My name is Peter Tennant, alias Black Dog Runner, and I'm a mental health blogger, fundraiser, and campaigner. My blog was shortlisted for a Mind Media Award in 2014, and last September I ran the Great North Run in aid of Mind, whilst dressed as a 9-foot black dog, to raise awareness of depression. But when I'm not running around Tyneside in a silly costume, I'm one of the 100,000 or so students here in the Northeast, so student mental health is something particularly close to my heart, especially given I was first diagnosed with depression when I was an undergraduate. In many senses, the challenges of being a student are the same as for any young adult. But I think there's also a number of ways that student life is especially demanding for mental health. To get an idea of what some of these issues are, I had a chat with Rebecca Bates, or Becky, a second-year undergraduate student at Newcastle University. The conversation starts with me talking about that most prominent source of anxiety, the exam. My very first experience of a panic attack was first day of my final exams. So I went in there, I knew I had about 30% of my whole degree being decided in the next 2 days. I opened the exam booklet and the questions kind of all blurred in front of me and my brain completely abandoned me. And I experienced something that I'd never had before. Suddenly it just all ran away and I could feel my whole degree sliding away. And
I think that's part of it with like uni life, because you do sort of, you feel like it's the be-all and end-all, you know, you're going at 18, you've chosen your course for the rest of your life, and then if it doesn't work out, you've got that pressure you're going through and everything matters, especially from second year onwards, it's being, like, counted as part of your degree, and every exam you do wrong could be the end of it, and so you feel guilty if you're not working outside of lectures, but then you're exhausted and you also do need a social life because you need a support network, and to be honest, friendship's really important,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, everyone has this belief, you know, you go to university, they're the best years of your life. They were some of the hardest years of my life. And I kind of feel guilty for that. I kind of feel ashamed, embarrassed.
You're going to meet who you're going to marry, you know, you've got to do the Will and Kate thing. And like, your freshers week's supposed to be incredible, but then you've got this pressure to be a completely new person. Maybe you want to reinvent yourself a bit, but you also have this pressure to just be drinking a ridiculous amount.
The alcohol culture, for me personally, was a real challenge because I came from a family where there's a lot of alcohol use, shall we say, and I have lost family members from alcohol abuse. I kind of made a decision to try not to drink alcohol. That was really difficult.
Well, even if you try and do something like sport where alcohol isn't inherently part of it, you've got your sports team socials, it's the way of the team bonding, and you're missing out on being a real part of the team if you don't, which I do think is a real benefit of the fact we are getting more and more, like Muslim students, for example, where for religious reasons they don't drink, so you see them going out and still being part of the team, and you know, whether they drink energy drinks or they just drink soft drinks, they're still part of it, and I think that gives the sort of confidence to just go, actually, this is my choice. Alcohol doesn't work for me.
The fact is you're away from your normal social support networks, you're away from your family. That may or may not be a good thing. Of course, for some people that's a real benefit. But nevertheless, you're young, you're uncertain, you're thrown into a new environment where, as well as work, which is the most obvious thing, suddenly you've got all that pressure and expectation, you also have to look after yourself.
Things like laundry that potentially your parents have been doing for ages, which they're an easy thing to get into the routine of, but to start with, You're still, it's still a big thing to take on for yourself. And it sounds really stupid, but things like that and planning meals and making sure that you've got the basics as well as like your main meat and stuff, but having sauces and things to actually turn it into a meal and there's a lot more to looking after yourself than I think you first realise.
I had, it's now an eating disorder. It wasn't when I was at university, but the DSM-5 has officially upgraded my unusual eating to be an official eating disorder. And that was a huge challenge living in halls where food is catered for you and the choice is often quite limited. That was a big issue for me. It basically meant that I didn't eat and I used to lose 2 to 3 stone during the term time and then try and fatten up during the holidays.
On the other side of that, if you're in a self-catered hall and you've got a predisposition to wanting to control your eating or any other eating disorders, you've been given control of your diet, and that's a really big responsibility, especially if you are recovering from something serious. You've come out of, like, up to the age of 18, you're probably in children's mental health services, and you've moved regions, you've moved support, and you've gone into the adult service, and you're also having to look after yourself. So it's a real, like, you lose a lot of support whilst also gaining a lot of independence. That can be a real challenge, I think, to add on to the increase of,
I think
everything else.
I think that transitional stage, if you do have a mental health problem that's being diagnosed during your childhood, which is increasingly happening these days, you are under the child mental health support system, and then suddenly you move area, you have to re-register with your GP, you may have to reconnect with services. Again, that adds an awful lot more pressure.
I think as well, when you're making friends in the first week of freshers, if you've got something that's going like ongoing and you're still suffering from, say, depression, you're not going to want to tell the people you've just joined a flat with that you're suffering from this. So if you do have a low period, you're not maybe going to be able to talk to the people closest to you. You're maybe going to be reliant on speaking to parents at home. That's another challenge and another step you've got to take.
I completely agree. I had a close friend of mine die of childhood cancer 2 weeks into freshers. And unsurprisingly, I went through a period of grief that turned into depression. But to actually communicate that to the people that I was trying to establish new friendships with was very difficult.
There's a real problem as well with anything like this, where you don't want to burden other people. It's a real, I hate the word burden, but it is what you feel. You don't want to, like, everyone's got their own struggles, and if you're thinking that your problems aren't that significant because you're suffering them, so you don't register, you don't want to then look at someone else who's going through the same, they're doing the same studying, they're doing the same social activities, why can't you cope when they can?
Yes.
Things like that, you compare yourself constantly, you've got a lot more people to compare yourself to.
I suppose, again, when you start university, it's a very exposing time. To a certain extent, you're being tested as a social animal as well as an intellectual animal. You want people to like you, you want to fit in, you want to make friends. And actually, if you are struggling with all kinds of different problems, not necessarily mental health problems, I mean, this is very normal, I think, to go into that environment and to think, I really want to fit in, I really want to make friends. And then if that's difficult, if that's challenging, how that might actually end up affecting you, how you might end up quite isolated.
You're given this big range of societies, like, you will find the society that will be perfect for you, you'll find your uni family, and if you don't find that quickly, like, it took me until second year to find the group that I'm really happy being a part of, which happened to be through volunteering, but it wasn't an instant, you know, oh, I've joined the baking society and they're my fit, but you do feel like you're supposed to find like-minded people very quickly and settle in, and even if you've been sort of maybe a bit of an outsider or something at school, you're supposed to then find your group at uni. And if you haven't found them, what's wrong with you? And it's very easy to sort of snowball that into sort of maybe not leaving your room or not participating because you don't feel like you've made the right type of friends or you've made the right decisions with your freshers.
There is that sense that you just can't ever escape from academic work. It's, you have a 9-to-5 job, that's fine. You go home at 5 o'clock. And you can put
your
feet up.
You've got permission to relax.
When do you relax? I mean, when do you have permission to relax? When you're doing something where you could always do that little bit more?
I'm lucky in that, for me, I feel most relaxed when I'm volunteering. So it means that what I'm doing is still relevant to my CV. If I were looking at it, like, I'm not. It's just I like working with children. So if I go along and I work at the hospital for 2 hours, I feel great afterwards. And obviously that's still a productive thing. And it's sort of, well, partly for me, it's affirming that I'm an important person that I should be around. It's that self-worth thing as well. But I just really enjoy it. So I'm lucky. But I think there is something in the fact that I think university is very big on extracurriculars. The job market at the moment especially is very competitive. You know, it's not enough to get a first or a 2-1. You need it, and you need experience of, you know, being on a committee of a society or having a part-time job, doing something more.
So there we are, a quick run through just some of the mental health challenges of student life. Becky and myself will be returning over the coming months to look at some of these issues in more detail.
Know that.
I do know this.
You did know it. Thanks, Carol. But we're pressed for time, so I obviously just want to say a huge thank you to listening to the show. Thank you to everybody involved.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been
so
Kelly, amazing. Yeah.
Gareth.
Yeah.
Tora, yourself.
You, Carol, thank yourself.
Danny? Yeah. Del, yes.
So, honestly,
thank you
so
much for everyone that's pulled it all together. Everyone's
and
worked
thank,
very
thank
hard.
Thank you, everybody who's listening. Apparently, people have been talking on Facebook and whatever, and it's been a huge honour for me to do this. I'm really glad to be a part of it, and I'm sure everyone else involved is. Don't mind me saying that at all.
Oh, no. Thank you, Kyle.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle, from the radio station for letting us be on. I think it's highly appropriate to end this with Emily Sandair Read All About It, because it's a great song. But thank you so much for tuning in to Mentally Sound here on Gravity Radio Northeast, and we'll see you very soon. Take care, guys. Thanks.
Bye.